This is the Online Movie Show with Phil Hall, broadcast from Platinum Wolf Studios. And here's your host, Phil Hall.
My inspiration to become a professional writer was based on my love of the work of Rod Serling. Everybody knows Rod Serling from Twilight Zone, but he actually had a rather wide and varied career. On today's show, we're going to be talking about Rod Serling with Nicholas Parisi. He's the author of the new book, Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination. So, Nick Parisi, why did you decide to do a book on Rod Serling?
Well, I mean, Rod Serling has been, you know, he's one of my heroes since I was 9 or 10 years old. And, you know, I, like everybody else, I got into the Twilight Zone first. I mean, I became a fanatic of that show, you know, when I was 10 or 11 or 12 years old. And just gradually over the years, I became aware of all this other work that he had done, you know, before and after the Twilight Zone. And I became, you know, interested in all of that work and interested in documenting it, because there's been so many books on the Twilight Zone and one really good book on Night Gallery, but that's pretty much it. You know, his other work really had not been addressed in the fashion that this book addresses it. So I wanted to, you know, put together a book that actually addressed his entire career, show by show, series by series, all the way through, and that had never been done before. So that was really the motivation behind it, to just kind of to shed some light on some of this other work that he had done outside of the Twilight Zone, and also to kind of just be able to provide a complete record of his career.
I just want to clarify something with Twilight Zone. Rod Serling did not write every single episode of the series, did he?
No, of course not. No, but he did. He wrote 92 of the 156, which is pretty amazing. Yeah, it's really unfathomable that one person could write that much in five seasons, 92 episodes. It's really, nobody does that. It's just, he was a machine. He just wrote and wrote and wrote. He was a compulsive writer. He was a fast writer. And yeah, so he wrote 92 of them. The bulk of the remaining episodes were written by Richard Matheson, Charles Beaumont, and George Clayton Johnson. They combined to write another 40 episodes of the series together, or at least be credited with writing 40 episodes of the series. And then the balance of, you know, 20 or so were written by various people. But those four writers pretty much wrote 80% of the, or 85% of the shows.
What I love about Twilight Zone is not just the scripts, which, as I mentioned in the introduction to this episode, inspired me to be a writer, but Serling himself as the host introducing it and that incredible voice. When I was a kid back in the 70s, Serling was a narrator of one of my favorite TV shows, which was The Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau. Mm. Did Serling have a background as an actor or as an announcer? Because he had a voice which was really one in a million.
Yeah, he did. He started in radio. He started in radio. We interned at a lot of different radio stations. Radio, when Serling was starting his career, radio was it. I mean, radio was king. You know, so he did. He interned at stations in Binghamton and Syracuse, I believe. Certainly in Ohio, where he went to school. He went to college in Yellow Springs, Ohio, Antioch College. And he did a lot of radio there. He wrote radio scripts, but he also did, you know, announcing and you know, voiceovers and that kind of thing. And he, when he interned at these places, he very often appeared in the shows that he either wrote or didn't write. He would appear in these shows. So some of these do exist. And yeah, so his voice was so distinctive, and you know, so he was the perfect voice for the Twilight Zone. And he ended up doing, you know, as you probably know, as you said, he narrated Jacques Cousteau, and he ended up doing so many commercials and voiceovers for so many different, you know, commercials and films that he used that, you know, to his advantage.
So when did he make his first mark as a writer? What was the play or the story that put him on the map?
Well, the one that really put him on the map was called Patterns, which aired on Kraft Theater in 1955, January of 1955. By this point, he had had 5 years of selling scripts to television and to radio. His first radio sale was in 1949, and his first television sale was in 1950. And so he'd been, you know, writing, he wrote some pretty good stuff, you know, before Patterns, but Patterns was the one that literally made him a star overnight. It was a live drama on Kraft Theater. It was about an executive from Cincinnati who is kind of he's hired by a New York City big firm, and he doesn't realize that he's been hired basically to take the place of an older executive who they're trying to force out. And he becomes conflicted about this. You know, he wants the job, but he doesn't want to force this guy out. He feels bad for the guy, and he comes to like the guy, and he sees how the, you know, the boss is just berating this guy and trying to force him to leave. And his, you know, he has an ethical conundrum there to, you know, to deal with. So this play, it received rave reviews from everywhere, particularly from the New York Times, that called it the best thing that had ever aired on television. I mean, literally, this was like a leap above for television. And at the time, you know, people today may not realize what it was like then, but what it was like then when something like this aired live on television, the next morning when the reviews came out, it was like the opening of a Broadway play. It was, you know, if something got rave reviews, it was noticed. And for the first time, by popular demand, it was actually repeated. They re-performed it a month later with the same cast, again, live performance, because it had generated such interest and such great reviews. And that turned Serling from a working kind of middle of the road writer into this in demand, you know, top of the heap television writer right overnight, literally.
I understand Patterns was also made into a motion picture. How successful was the film version?
The film version was not a success at the box office. It came out about a year after the television play aired. And I think, you know, Serling said at one point, and I think he was dead on this, is that I think people were reluctant to pay for something that they had just seen on television, maybe even twice. You know, so the film version is very, very good. And it actually is one of the, you know, maybe misperceptions from, you know, maybe prior things that have been written about Serling, that it got very good reviews. Again, a rave from the New York Times, Time Magazine, Newsday. I mean, there's some major publications gave it 4-star reviews, and it was a very good film. I think today I like the television version better, but the film is very good. But again, it was not a box office success, unfortunately.
I think Serling followed up Patterns with a play which is my personal favorite of his output, and that's Requiem for a Heavyweight. And it was an extraordinary work with Jack Palance, who was not the most subtle of actors, giving, I think, maybe the performance of a lifetime in that. And also Ed Wynn, who was a wacky comic, doing a dramatic role. And that was a stunner unto itself.
Yes. Requiem for Heavyweight actually aired almost 2 years after Patterns. It was about a year and, you know, about 21 months. And the reason I'm so precise about that is because that 21-month period between Patterns and Requiem for Heavyweight is a very interesting period for Serling, because he spent that entire 21 months, he felt, trying to live up to the reputation he had built on Patterns. And he kept trying to top Patterns after he came out, and he was unable to. Now, what I point out in the book is that he wrote a lot of really good stuff in between Patterns and Requiem for Heavyweight. One particular is called The Rack, that you may have heard of. The Rack was made into a feature film as well, starring Paul Newman. And that was a terrific script that didn't quite translate to television as well, you know, as well as it should have, but it was a terrific script. And he wrote a lot of very good stuff, but none of it quite cracked that, you know, that critical acclaim that Patterns had gotten until Requiem for Heavyweight. And when that aired on Playhouse 90, it was the second episode of Playhouse 90, and it was the first 90-minute play written especially for television. The first episode was that Serling also wrote. The first episode was based on a novel, so this was the first one that was especially written for television, and it got even better reviews than Patterns. It was acclaimed across the board. The next year, it just virtually swept the Emmy Awards. Jack Palance won, Serling won, the director won, it won for Best Show of the Year. So it was a huge hit. And Ed Wynn is a very interesting story. I mean, Ed Wynn was, as you said, he was a wacky comic. He was not known as a dramatic actor, that's for sure. And the interesting story about Requiem for Heavyweight is that Ed Wynn, his rehearsals for that show were terrible. He could not break the persona of the wacky comic. He had a particular character called the Perfect Fool, and he kept slipping into that persona of the Perfect Fool and delivering the lines with that affectation, that kind of goofy affectation. And Serling and everyone else was convinced that he was going to ruin the play. And the producer, to his credit, Martin Manulis, was just stuck by Ed Wynn. He said, listen, this guy's been in the business for 50 years. I believe that he's a professional and he'll get this done. And he gave a beautiful performance. Ultimately, he gave a great performance, and Serling to for the rest of his career was indebted to Ed Wynn for that performance, and apologetic for how he misjudged him and underestimated him.
A lot of people may not realize this, but Requiem for a Heavyweight was also performed on the BBC.
Yes.
We have Sean Connery as the boxer, the role that Jack Palance played. How did that get over there? That wasn't very common for American television plays to be adapted into British TV.
It was starting to be done around this time, and Serling actually had several of his playhouse 90s were adapted onto on the BBC. I don't know if Requiem was the first. I believe there may have been one before that, and I'm sure I outlined it in the book. But yes, Requiem was done on the BBC, and Jack Palance was supposed to reprise his role. And for various reasons, he pulled out, and they were forced to go with, you know, this unknown, you know, actor making his first television, you know, his television debut, and it was Sean Connery. And the BBC performance got similarly great reviews as the American version. It went over very well there as well.
Also, some people may not realize there was another unknown actor in the cast in a small role. It was Michael Caine.
Yes, yes.
as well. That version, unfortunately, doesn't exist. At least there's no kinescope of it.
No, unfortunately. Just fairly recently, within the last, say, 5 years, the audio of the performance was discovered. So the audio of it exists, strangely enough, but the video does not. So the audio is at the BBC, the British Film Institute. They have the audio of it, which I've never heard. But that would be interesting to hear. But the video, no, unfortunately, does not exist.
Well, that was also made into a film. I'm not a big fan of the film version of Requiem for a Heavyweight. The casting, to me, was a bit on the strange side. Did Serling have any role in the film production?
Well, he wrote the screenplay again. He adapted the screenplay into the film version, and I'm sure he had some input into the casting. He did not like Anthony Quinn replacing Jack Palance. He ultimately didn't like Anthony Quinn's performance, and I tend to agree with him actually on that. But I'm sure he did not have much objection to Mickey Rooney and Jackie Gleason. Mickey Rooney was one of his favorites, and Mickey Rooney's terrific in it, and Jackie Gleason's very good also, I think. But yeah, so I you know, that would be more the director and the producer. I'm sure I had more input as far as the casting goes, but I'm sure Serling had some. But yeah, he did go. Serling was on record. You know, Requiem was his favorite piece. I don't think there's any question about it. Requiem was the favorite. His favorite of all of his work as far as the television version. He never said a bad word about the television version, but he was not crazy about the film version, particularly because of the performances.
Well, if anyone has never seen the film version, the beginning of the film is a bit of a surprise. There was an up-and-coming boxer who had a small part in that. Do you want to tell the audience about it?
Well, his name was Cassius Clay, and he's credited as Cassius Clay. That was his name at the time, and Muhammad Ali, of course. And yeah, and that opening is very well done. I mean, you see the from the point of view of in the film version, it's Mountain Rivera as opposed to Mountain McClintock, but it's from Mountain Rivera's point of view, getting pummeled by Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay, and it's very well filmed, very well done. And yeah, so it's certainly a more realistic, you know, the TV just couldn't do the boxing as well as the film version did. And, you know, it's more gritty, it's more dark. And I like the film version. I certainly like the television version better, but the film version has some points going for it.
It must have been a funny distraction back in 62 when you're seeing in the film and all of a sudden this Cassius Clay, who was Olympic champion, was well-known boxer, and here he is pummeling Anthony Quinn. So.
Yeah. It tells you a little bit that he was already on his way to being more than a boxer, Muhammad Ali. He was, you know, there he was, larger than life on the screen, and he already had that persona. Yeah.
The Twilight Zone is an interesting part of TV history because up until then, most of science fiction on TV was aimed at the kiddie audience with Captain Video and Johnny Jupiter and those type of shows. And here you had science fiction in prime time. How did Twilight Zone come about?
Well, that's exactly right. That up until that point, and not only had it been aimed at the kids, but that was just the general philosophy about it. That was the way science fiction was viewed at the time by television executives in general, was that science fiction was something for 6-year-olds or 8-year-olds, and it wasn't an adult thing to do. And Serling had to, luckily, Serling, he had built his name so greatly at that point. You know, as I said, 1955 was a huge hit for him with Patterns. And then by the time Twilight Zone debuted in 1959, he was without a doubt the top television writer. He had won 3 consecutive Emmy Awards, and he had the prestige. So he was able to kind of call his own shots on on creating a series. They let him create a series, and he had always loved science fiction. He loved science fiction and fantasy and horror, and he loved that stuff. So when he got a chance to do what he wanted to do, he said, all right, I'm going to do this science fiction show. And there certainly was a lot of skepticism, you know, about him doing it. It was the big dramatic live television writer going to do a 30-minute film science fiction series. It was very strange. He said it was, they looked at him like it was like Stan Musial leaving the Cardinals to go coach third base in the Little League game. That's the way they looked at it. But he knew what he was doing, and so he approached it certainly from an adult standpoint. He was not going to talk down to the audience whatsoever, and it worked. It worked beautifully.
Well, it's in a way, it's really not science fiction. These are morality plays. It's good and evil. It's the best and worst of human emotions. It's not just giant tarantulas from Saturn coming down to take over the planet. This was a type of science fiction that had not been seen on TV, and quite frankly, hadn't been seen in movies either.
Yes, I mean, it was Rod Serling taking that genre of science fiction and using it to tell these morality plays, these morality tales, and that was part of the purpose of it. Rod Serling believed that art, by definition, has to say something about something. I mean, that to him was the definition of art. If you're not going to say something about something, then it's just entertainment, which could be fine. But he wanted to entertain people, but there always had to be a purpose. There always had to be something in there that he wanted to say. So on Twilight Zone, yes, Rod Serling wrote 92 of them, and virtually every one of them has some kind of a message. It doesn't have to be a sledgehammer over your head, but it has some kind of message about the human condition, about our need for companionship, about the effects of prejudice, about all these issues that really burned in Rod Serling that he wanted to talk about, and he had frankly gotten he wasn't able to talk about very much in straight dramatic shows because the censors would get a hold of him and they would force him to change these things. Well, in science fiction, he was able to get away with it, not so much because. Basically, with science fiction, a lot of the executives at the time, they just didn't get it. Not that they were stupid or, that they, didn't get that he was doing these things in analogies or, an allegory, but they just didn't get science fiction in general. I mean, I tell a few stories in the book about how, some of the sponsors particularly, they're a type of people who just didn't get fantasy or science fiction. It was just kind of beyond their ability to they couldn't wrap their brain around it. So when he was talking about the effects of prejudice or something, they just didn't quite get it because they kind of stopped paying attention once the monster showed up. That's just the way it worked, unfortunately. But yes, it was not monsters. He was very very specific that it was not going to be a weekly monster show. That was maybe Outer Limits did that later, but not the Twilight Zone. No.
Well, anybody who converses about Twilight Zone always says, well, my favorite episode is this one or that one. So let me ask you the obvious question. What's your favorite episode?
At this moment, it might change tomorrow, but at this moment, I would have to say Walking Distance, Rod Serling's first season episode about his desire to go back to his childhood in Binghamton, New York. It's, for those who haven't seen the episode, it's about a stressed out New York City executive named Martin Sloan, he's at a dead run and he wants to go back to an innocent, more innocent time, a simpler time. And he walks to his old hometown and realizes that he's gone back in time and he gets to meet himself as a young boy. And he tells himself as a young boy to, cherish this while it lasts, cherish your childhood because it's not going to last forever. And, things are not always going to be this good. The summer and cotton candy and bandstands and carousels are not always going to be here. And it's just Rod Serling at his most, most Serling-esque, this was just Rod Serling just pouring it on. And, that one to me, the older I get, of course, for obvious reasons, the more I love that particular episode. If you had asked me, maybe a couple of years ago, there are a couple of Charles Beaumont episodes that have always been among my favorites. One is The Howling Man, about a traveler who comes upon a monastery where they say they have the devil locked up inside the monastery. That one, when I first saw that one when I was maybe 10 years old, just blew my socks off. I was just floored by the episode. And that was my favorite one for years, I would say, The Howling Man was. And another Charles Beaumont called Shadow Play, about a man who is dreaming that he's on the on death row and constantly being executed in the electric chair. Again, that's one of my favorites for sure. But Walking Distance would be my top one at this point.
Well, if I had to volunteer mine, I don't know if Serling wrote this one. That was, and I don't remember the exact title, but it was with Agnes Moorehead as the isolated rural woman whose farmhouse is invaded by a small spaceship. Was that his
work? No, it's called The Invaders, and that was a Richard Matheson, actually. Yeah. Yes, and that's one of the most well-remembered episodes of the series.
And it's astonishing because there's no dialogue up until the very, very end, in which the twist is just mind-blowing. But the fact that they would put a half-hour dialogue-free episode. The only other person who did that was Ernie Kovacs, and he did that as a comedy.
So
here's Serling presenting this as well. I mean, well, actually, there was another episode which had almost no dialogue, and, well, Serling didn't write that. That was the occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge.
Yes.
And the story, I think, was that they were one episode short for that season, and is that a true story or not?
Not quite. Not exactly. What it was that, it was in the fifth season, and they were just looking for ways to cut the budget, and they just had the chance to buy that particular film, and they said, oh, wow, we can buy this film for less than we could to produce our own episode, so let's do it. So they were able to edit it. It was actually like a 42-minute short film, I believe, and they were able to edit it down to, it was a little over half an hour, I think, and they were able to edit it down to 24 minutes for a Twilight Zone episode, so they were able to save some money and do it that way,
It's a French film, but the dialogue is in English, and it takes place during the Civil War, and if you've not seen the film, by all means, see it. It's the funny thing is that the film went on to win the Academy Award. And I think because it was on Twilight Zone, more people saw that film than a lot of the short films in competition.
Almost certainly, yeah. And it had won the Palme d'Or at Cannes before it was on the Twilight Zone, actually. So it was already had some prestige before it aired on Twilight Zone.
So we're talking about Rod Serling and a lot of his television work, and we mentioned a couple of his TV plays that were adapted to films. What was his relationship like with the Hollywood movie studios? He didn't write very many Hollywood film scripts, did he?
No, not too many. He was, after Patterns, when he was in such demand, he, of course, had overtures from Hollywood producers, and he did sign a contract with MGM to write motion pictures. And for that period of the contract, this is, again, in 1955 to 1958, let's say, He did not have any success. He was writing, he wrote a lot of unproduced scripts. he wrote a lot of scripts that ended up being rewritten by other people and produced with other people's scripts. And frankly, he was still kind of cutting his teeth and learning how to write a feature length screenplay. And he was not very good at it. So he had a lot of difficulty at that point. But he did write, as we said, he did write the adaptation for Patterns, which was very good. And he wrote a few other things. I mean, he wrote a film called Saddle the Wind, which was a Western that he loved to make fun of, but which is actually a pretty good movie. It is not an embarrassment by any means. It's a perfectly entertaining Western. If you ever want to check that out, it's perfectly fine to check that one out. And then he wrote the adaptation for Requiem for Heavyweight. And after that, he The Rack, as I said, was produced as a feature film, but another writer got the credit for writing that particular screenplay, even though this is kind of going off the track. But in the book, I do argue that Serling certainly should have gotten co-credit for that particular screenplay, because it's almost, I mean, they used his television play almost verbatim, so I'm not sure why he didn't get credit for that one. But, and then, of course, he co-wrote Planet of the Apes, in 1968. So that was, the big hit that he had among his film work. And I should mention, I missed the finest screenplay of his career is 7 Days in May. He wrote the screenplay of 7 Days in May that was, critically acclaimed. It's seen as a classic at this point. It's a political thriller about a coup d'etat to take over the American government. And, he wrote that one in 1963 while he was working on The Twilight Zone. So he was just able to bang out this incredible script, the best script of his career, while he was writing all this other stuff, which is pretty amazing.
Which is rather eerie, because by the time 7 Days in May came out, President Kennedy had already been assassinated, and there were a lot of conspiracy theories that there was a coup d'etat.
Yeah, and that was a concern when the film. I believe that the film actually was the opening was delayed even because of the Kennedy assassination. They didn't want to obviously release it so close to it, so it was pushed back somewhat. So that did happen.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, with currents at Owl Creek Bridge, there's some urban legends regarding Serling and his work. And I think with Planet of the Apes script, I've read so many different stories about how the film came together. One story is that Serling's script had to be almost entirely rewritten because it was unusable. One source said that he came up with the ending of the film. Another source said that Arthur Jacobs was in a diner and he saw a poster of the Statue of Liberty and he came up with the ending. What exactly was Serling's role in adapting the work? Because it was based on a French novel by Pierre Boulez called Monkey Planet, and the film is very, very different from the original French novel.
Yes, it is, and it's. I'm glad you said that because that is one of the points in Serling's favor in terms of this argument is because the film is much different than the book, and basically the Serling's history with Planet of the Apes is that he was the first one to work on the film. He was actually first contacted by a production company called King Brothers Productions, and King Brothers was known for really schlocky, low-budget movies. I mean, they had a film called Gorgon, which was a real Godzilla ripoff kind of movie, and a Sinbad movie, The Legends of Sinbad. That was a real low-budget version of Sinbad. And they had contacted Serling in early, I believe it was 1964, right after the book came out, right after the book was published. And they asked if he'd be interested, and they sent him the book, and he immediately began to work on it. And he wrote a couple of drafts for King Brothers that were completely different than anything, you know, that he wrote later. But he wrote a couple of drafts for them, and then they kind of dropped out one way or the other. They either lost their option on the film or whatever it was. And then Arthur Jacobs became the owner of the property, and then he officially hired Serling to write the script. And he wrote several drafts for Arthur Jacobs, and the primary problem with Serling's scripts is that originally it was set in a modern city. He had the apes existing in a modern city, you know, wearing hats and clothes and doing all the things that we would do. And to do that, to make that kind of a movie was going to be too expensive. That was just a given. And so eventually, basically what happened was Arthur Jacobs shopped this script, shopped the project to every studio in Hollywood, and everybody turned it down, not because of Serling's script, but just because it was seen as too risky. How are we going to make people believe that these apes talk? You know, how are we going to make people not laugh at these apes talking? Because they all had this fear that it was going to be Dr. Doolittle, that it was going to be a Disney film. Yeah, that was really
which
the
was
fear.
Produced by Arthur Jacobs.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly right, yes. So they had that fear, and the script bounced around for about 2 years, and Serling worked on it for about 2.5 years, and it still had not gotten any commitment from any studio. And they realized that they were going to have to rewrite the script to put it in a pre-modernized setting. And they kind of mutually parted ways at that point. Serling admitted that he just felt like he had written himself out on it. He had written enough on it. He was burnt out on it. And they went and they got Michael Wilson come in. Now, the first thing is to set the record straight. Yes, Rod Serling wrote the ending. I mean, that's as clear as black and white. It's in his early drafts. He wrote the ending. It's there. The Statue of Liberty is there in his earlier drafts. So Michael Wilson certainly didn't write the ending. Whether Arthur Jacobs had the idea, you know, Serling always said it was his idea in collaboration with Arthur Jacobs. I mean, he was the producer, and, you know, film is a collaborative art. You're always working with actors and producers and directors and everything else. So he admitted that maybe they, you know, batted the idea around. But the bottom line is Serling is credited with writing that ending because it's there. It's there in his original scripts. And Michael Wilson came in, and Michael Wilson essentially rewrote almost all of Rod Serling's dialogue, 99% of it. In fact, I think there's two lines that remain in the finished version that are Rod Serling's. One of them, I can tell you for sure, is at the end when Charlton Heston, Taylor, asks Zira for a kiss, and she says, "But you're so damn ugly." That's Rod Serling. And there was one other one. I forget what that one was. But what Michael Wilson did was he kept Serling's structure. He kept basically the same plotline. It was essentially the same things happen at the same times. Lots of the visuals are directly from Serling's script. Or lots of the plot, the incidental plot moments are from Serling's script. So Serling and Wilson, shared credit on the screenplays by Michael Wilson and Rod Serling, because Rod Serling deserved that because he had given it the structure. He had taken Boulez's novel and made it filmable. And what you mentioned about it being so different from the novel, that's a very key point because, if Michael Wilson had come in and without Rod Serling's script and just gone from the novel, we would have a completely different movie right now. Absolutely 100% different. But the fact that he had Rod Serling's drafts to work from, that's why we ended up with what we ended up with. So it's perfectly reasonable that they both shared 50-50 credit on the final version.
In the late 60s, Rod Serling returned to television with Night Gallery. I have to admit, I'm not a big fan of the TV show, though the pilot film is something which was a favorite of mine as a kid. What is your opinion of Night Gallery?
Night Gallery was a very mixed bag, as Twilight Zone was. I mean, to be fair, all 156 episodes of the Twilight Zone are not gems. There's a lot of bad stuff on the Twilight Zone. We don't want to deify that series too much. But my feeling about Night Gallery is, yes, it's a mixed bag. But the thing it has, the thing that Twilight Zone has over Night Gallery, I think, is that Twilight Zone's highs were much higher than Night Gallery's highs, and Night Gallery's lows are miles lower, in my opinion, than Twilight Zone's lows. That's where the disconnect is that there's some stuff on Night Gallery that is just absolutely, positively, embarrassingly bad. Whereas I don't think I'm a little generous on Twilight Zone, but I don't think there's anything on that show that's that embarrassingly bad. But there are episodes of Night Gallery that are that bad. But having said that, I make it pretty clear in the book that I think Rod Serling wrote some of his best stuff for Night Gallery. There were a couple of episodes of Night Gallery that I would put up against anything that Serling ever wrote, particularly a show called The Messiah on Mott Street, which was an episode about an old Jewish man who is on his deathbed and he wants to stay alive for his grandson. His grandson is all he has and he's all his grandson has, and they live for each other, and he just wants to stay alive for his grandson, but he feels that the angel of death is waiting for him. And it's about he has this belief, the old man has this belief that the Messiah is going to visit the squalor of Mott Street. They live in the tenements, and that the Messiah is going to come before he dies. And it's a beautiful, beautiful script that that Serling wrote for Night Gallery that I think is among the best things he ever wrote. As you said, I think the pilot film is very, very good. Those are the three stories in that are very, very good. And there are a handful of other episodes that I think are terrific, too. I mean, one of Serling's favorite pieces was called They're Tearing Down Tim Riley's Bar for Night Gallery, which is a kind of a walking distance sequel. It's the same type of idea as Walking Distance was, about a burnt out executive who wants to go back in time. But that was one of his favorites. And there are some other really, really good episodes of Night Gallery. But Night Gallery, the problem with Night Gallery was that Rod Serling had no control over anything beyond his scripts, production, cast, directors, nothing. He was not the producer of the show. He did not demand creative control of the show, and that really killed him. He never had the relationship with the series that he had with Twilight Zone. So it lacked in those areas because he didn't have his hand in those things.
Rod Serling was a relatively young man when he died. Hypothetically, if he had not passed away so young, what would have happened with his career?
It's a really good question. He was 50 years old when he died, and he had not actually had anything produced on television for about a year and a half at the time he died. 1973 was really the last time that he had a script produced, really the last episode of Night Gallery that he wrote was the last thing. And actually one script that he had completed aired about a year after he died. So that was the last thing that aired that he had actually written while he was alive. But where he would have gone is hard to say. I mean, he wrote, there were some things that were not produced that were very good towards the end of his life that are still sitting out there waiting for waiting for a smart producer to come and grab them. I won't go into those too much, but some of that is there. But, you know, the end of Rod Serling's life is very, very interesting. You know, in the book, one of the reasons I wrote the book is that I think the period after The Twilight Zone from 1965 to 1975, when Rod Serling died, is an interesting period in Serling's career. And in other publications, I think it's been painted as this steady decline from 65 to 75. It was just, he just dropped off the precipice and he never did anything good ever again. And I think that's nonsense. I think he wrote a lot of really great stuff. But that last year or two is an interesting period, because the last 2 year or two, he was really just doing commercials and voiceovers and writing some things that were not produced. So I don't know where he would have gone if he would have kind of gotten the second wind or third wind to get back into producing, things that would have been produced and, that would have been really good. I don't know. I know there's some material there that could have been, but I really don't know. It's such a mystery.
I had read someplace that he was supposed to be the original host of the series In Search Of, which Leonard Nimoy took over. Is that correct?
Yeah, I believe so, because In Search Of was essentially spun off from the two films that Serling did narrate, which were In Search of Ancient Astronauts and In Search of Ancient Mysteries. So yeah, I think for sure he would have continued on the television series if he had not died.
Which I guess then would have kept him in the public eye, because In Search Of was a major show for many years.
Yes, yeah, that I think we can say for sure he probably would have done that show, but whether he would have also been writing things at the same time, who knows?
Well, you wrote something wonderful. It's called Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination. It's published by the University Press of Mississippi. Nick Parisi, thank you so much for being here in the studio with us.
Thank you, Phil. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Online Movies Show with Phil Hall. We'll see you again next week. Take care.